God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. Newcomers, is there anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. Anybody here, first 30 days? On Zoom, you can raise your hand and somebody will chat with you. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Let's double check mine. Also, we respectfully ask those present to refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe the book Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism based on simple actions. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism by taking AA's simple action. The AA preamble says, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. So this evening, we are on step one, part two. Please help me welcome our panel this evening. We have Amy and Larry. So let's see, I'm not going to read you to death, but I'm going to read you a little bit. Okay, so tonight we're going to start on page 5 in Bill's story. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then. And I did. Larry, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Larry, alcoholic. Larry. My sobriety date is January 31st, 2017. I have a home group. It's Candlelight. We meet Fridays at 1301 Cali at 8 p.m. I have a service position in the home group. I have a sponsor, and I do have the opportunity, the privilege to sponsor other people, and show them what I've learned about the 12 steps. Step one, this part, I love this part of Bill's story because he details this guy who's constantly, coming to the conclusion that drinking for him is probably a bad idea, and he drinks anyways. And that's really my story, the last 10 years of my drinking. I'll tell a quick story. The first time that I ever came to the idea that drinking might be a bad idea. And for me, I remember in early sobriety, I'd go to like step one meetings and a lot of people would talk, drunkalogues. And a lot of things that people would say, I couldn't identify with. And I really developed this idea of what alcoholism was, which was consequences. You need to get a certain number of DUIs, maybe have your family leave you, crash a few cars, whatever the case may be. And a lot of those things I'd left behind a long time ago, you know, in my early 20s. I did a lot of those things. But the first, and none of that made me want to stop drinking. Honestly, what happened was the first time that I ever had the idea that I really need to stop, I was probably, I think I was 28, 29. And after a night of heavy drinking and outside issues, I wake up the next day and I think I'm going to die. And I didn't know what I was going through. I had no idea. I didn't know anything about detoxing. I had no clue. I had no frame of reference for any of this stuff. I know now that I was probably detoxing. But I woke up with the shivers, the shakes. I was dry heaving. And I tell my wife, I was like, you got to take me to the hospital. I think I'm dying. And they take me to the hospital. They put me on an IV drip. I think they gave me Ativan. They asked me about my drinking. I remember they asked me specifically, Mr. Williams, are you on Coke? And I was like, not right now. And which was true. That was not a lie. But I left that hospital after they did what they did. I left after a day or two. And I left that hospital. I distinctly remember walking out, much like the way Bill describes, I got to stop. This is out of control. And I had been doing this cycle for a few years, but it really wasn't that bad. You know, it was just like, you know, I'll be okay. But this was the first time I was like, I got to do something about this. I had all these other, like, I won't get into the consequences that were happening in my 20s, but I had that too, but it really was something else. Something came over me. And I remember walking out of Chesapeake General, looking at the sky, thinking, I'm done. I am done. And I was done for a year. I did a whole year. I was assisted with some other stuff that comes in different bottles, but for a whole year, I did not have a drip drop of alcohol. Didn't know about AA, didn't know about any of that stuff. But by the end of that year, I was like, I'm in a year. This really isn't that big of a problem. I'm probably cured of whatever was going on in my life then. I'm sure I'm better. And I convinced myself that maybe I made a too big of a deal about this drinking thing. And I started to drink again. But what that was the beginning of this cycle that they talk about in the doctor's opinion. For the next 10 years, I would quit every few weeks. And it was just this complete cycle where I would stop. I would start. Something would happen in my life. I'd come up with this firm resolution to be done. And I really meant it. You strap me to a lie detector test, put a gun to my head. I really meant it when I said it. And then for some reason, I'd be undone. And this would keep going on and on. So I had several step ones throughout that time. Step one wasn't enough for me. I could say, hey, I'm a drunk. The whole second part of that, my life was unmanageable. This obsession of the mind that kept convincing me that this time it'll be different. That would go on, like I said, for almost a decade until I started to hear the message that was being given about the 12 steps. I'll talk about that more later. That's all I got for this part.
Thanks.
Thank you, Lara.
Amy. I'm Amy. I'm an alcoholic. Hey. Hello. My sobriety date is September 5th of 2016, but I picked up my first white chip on December 5th of 2014. So it took me a little while to get anything that would stick. Which I thought was funny because that's today's date. I never wanted to quit drinking. It did not occur to me that I had a problem. It occurred to me after about 8 years of living with somebody else who liked to do the same things that I did, that person had a problem and I needed to go somewhere so that I could fix it or learn how to deal with it. A little bit of history. I actually grew up around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad was an alcoholic. My mom knew about Al-Anon. We went to open AA meetings, Al-Anon meetings, and I also went to Alateen. So when this person who was in my life had this problem that he didn't want to deal with, I knew where to go. I went to a different fellowship first, and I stayed there for a couple of months until I ran into somebody that I knew. There was like a meeting going on that was Al-Anon and a meeting, like an open meeting and a big book discussion in a different room. And a very good friend of mine got me up out of the Al-Anon meeting basically and carried me over to the open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's kind of where I stayed. To talk a little bit about the obsession part, it never occurred to me that I couldn't put the drink down when I first started coming around the rooms and was learning what it meant to like apply the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to myself. It didn't occur to me. Like I said, I didn't actually want to quit doing anything that I was doing. I just wanted to figure out how to deal with somebody else's problem. So it took me a little while. I was living in Tennessee, in Millington, Tennessee, when I realized that I guess, needed the 12 steps in a different kind of way. I had been going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings for years for myself. I was in and out of the rooms. I worked with sponsors. I took some steps. But it wasn't until I was sitting on my kitchen floor with an open refrigerator staring at bottles in the bottom rack, and I did not want to drink it. And I knew that I was going to. And that's what it looked like when I realized that I really had a problem and that I really wasn't going to be able to fix it on my own. I had been doing things like I was getting up in the morning, I was taking my daughter to school, I was driving 45 minutes out of the way to go to a liquor store that was in a different town, and then I would drink on the way home. I would be drunk during the day. I would go and pick up my daughter from school, and then I would come home. My wife would then come home, and then I would proceed to drink for the rest of the night. And that caused a lot of problems. I pushed people away, and you know, my daughter, for the most part, doesn't really remember. Doesn't remember too much. I wasn't like violent towards her or anything, but I was definitely neglectful of her. And she does remember that part. And it didn't occur to me, like I can remember thinking back then, like it didn't occur to me, like, you've got to stop this. I just knew that I was uncomfortable. And I knew the thing that would make me feel better. And it was my medicine. It was absolutely the easy medicine that I wanted. I didn't see any other way other than to do that routine over and over and over again. That's how I experienced the obsession of alcohol. And so that's all I have on that part.
All right. Thank you both. We're going to continue on page 7. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high, went to town regularly, even made it a little money. Surely this was the answer. Self-knowledge. We should really read the next line after that, but we don't. But it was not.
And he drinks again. That's a spoiler. Larry alcoholic. This, I went through this phase too, self-knowledge. Some people might say triggers. I know what makes me drink. It's my wife. It's the people I hang around. It's my situation in at work. It's all the people. If they would just get their stuff together, then I probably wouldn't drink the way that I drink. I'm only doing this because all of you people will not cater to my needs. And if I can just avoid people, places, and things, I won't drink. You know, I never really drank because of my close proximity to alcohol. That's not really, you know, just because I saw it. At this point, you know, I told you I was going through this cycle for the last 10 years of drinking. Within those times, I literally tried everything to control my not drinking, meaning in these periods of sobriety that I would have, weeks, months, I never quite went a year. Once again, I've never stepped into AA, don't really know anything about AA, but I had tried yoga, I had tried meditation retreats, 10-day silent meditation retreats, because I read an article how that helped addicts. Because at this time, I wasn't really saying I was an alcoholic. I was an addict. I read a lot of self-help books. You name it, I've tried to do that. I know more about alcoholism. It describes all the different ways we try to control our drinking. Did all that too. I used to go to bars and I would ask for a tall glass. But I'm like, just put the regular amount of liquor. Put more Coke in my whiskey and Coke. Because I had this idea that it would dilute it or it would get me full quicker. And all it was is I just would have more sugar with my alcohol. And I had developed all these ideas about I didn't want to, I had this belief that if I mixed light and dark liquors, that's what was making me black out and drink. I remember I Googled Asian flush and I thought like, that's what, you know, I must have some adverse reaction to alcohol because I keep blacking out every time I drink. So I'm trying to avoid all of these things. Let me switch this. Let me switch that. I can't hang with that person anymore. I can't go here. Can't do there. So I knew what made me drink. And that idea of what made me drink was you. It was all of you. And if I, and what started to happen is I started to become very reclusive. I stopped drinking at bars. I'm just going to drink at home now. I became a home drinker. I used to be a hangout kind of guy, you know, getting fights. I love getting in fights. I'm not the I love you, bro, kind of drinker. I am the what are you looking at kind of. I'm that guy that I want to fight. I used to love it. So now I'm just sitting at home every night, blacking out, missing out on my family. And I get to a point in 2014, my wife now has gone to AA. She went to rehab and found this cult called Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I called it at the time. Oh, you're in that cult. And she got sober. And she never called me an alcoholic. But in 2014, I had a knee surgery. I used to do a lot of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I tore my meniscus. They prescribed me some medication. And I was mixing that with alcohol. And she was like, look, you got a problem. And my response to her was, yeah, you're my problem. And she said, if you don't get help, I am going to. And I said, go for it. And she granted my wishes. And in 2015, she walked out. And I went pretty dark and pretty, went down a pretty dark hole. It got real, real bad. It got real, real bad. I moved in with my mother. We were on the verge of divorce. And I cranked up my getting sober and I got more self-help books and I went to more therapy and I did all this and none of it would work. I'd have moments of sobriety, usually brief. And then I'd convince myself that I got this. And then I'd wake up in some random person. That's usually what was happening when my wife and I were separated. And that cycle kept going on. And I'll talk about what happens. Maybe I don't know what we're reading. That's all I got for now.
Thanks, sir.
So looking back on what my life looked like, I had a lot of routine. You know, I went to work every day. I never lost a house. I never lost custody of my child. I had routine. I grew up more about my childhood in a family that was always doing self-help for something. A lot of people in my family have that. I've heard it said in the rooms, the disease of more, you know, you don't feel good about something, you eat something, you want more of that thing that makes you feel good. We like sweets in my house. My grandmother has a lot of self-help books. So they've always been around the house. They've always been there. The yoga stuff, the prayer and meditation, the daily reminders or the daily things that you read for yourself. Anyways, lots of that. So I always knew that I had like this thing to fall back on. It wasn't until I was in the rooms for a little while, working the steps, probably for like the second or third time, that I realized that I had always had a job because the first one, like my first big girl job, I worked as an in-court clerk and in the circuit court. I was laid off from that job. And I was laid off because I was the weakest link. I was not the best in-court clerk when like the recession hit and all that kind of stuff, like in 2008, 2009. So I was laid off, right? That's okay. I didn't get fired from another job because after he told me that he caught me stealing, I just never went back. I don't even know why he let me walk out the door, but he, you know, I just never went back. So I didn't get in any trouble. I just got a different job. And I never lost a house because we moved like every 9 to 12 months. And then I moved into a house that was owned by my uncle who would never kick me out. We weren't paying all of the rent on time. My family member just would not kick me out of the house. I never lost custody of my child. Because her dad is afraid of me. He was never going to fight me. He was never going to fight me for custody. It just was never going to happen. I looked better on paper. I will just leave it at that. I looked better on paper, but I was not. You know, part of the really rough time of my drinking and also my using, because I did that too. My routine was wake up in the morning. I had some vodka for my coffee. I went to work. Sometimes I would take my child to school, but sometimes she wasn't even with me, because that was another thing. My family support, my mom and my grandmother had my daughter a whole lot. And after work, I would stop at the bar on the way home from work. I would have a couple of drinks. I maybe would pick up my daughter. And by about 9 o'clock, it was time to go and get the other things that I desired while I was drinking. And it was, you know, rinse and repeat every day for years. So when I was actively starting to work a program in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, this routine that my sponsor and really my grand sponsor was talking about, you know, that became very important in my life. Like, I did not have any kind of a spiritual life prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous really became my higher power for a while. You know, it, that routine and that feel good that I would get from the self-help stuff, none of that, it wouldn't last. Like it didn't stick until I got into the rooms and actually started working a program. And that's all I've got.
Thank you, Bo. All right. So we're going to continue on page 24. By the way, we're talking about step one tonight. Step one is the only step that contains the problem. So a lot of these paragraphs are pretty heavy, pretty dark. It's not an uplifting, fun meeting, is it?
Let's get darker.
It's the problem. Page 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. Larry.
So, yeah, this part's written in italics, so it's important, right? I can't bring upon sufficient force. I'll tell you the one. I'll just tell you like the moment. This is my quicksand all around me. I admit my match. Alcohol was my master moment. Told you the wife leaves. She dips. Within a month, I get diagnosed with prostate cancer. Wife just left me. Living with my mom. Divorce papers are signed, but we haven't gone through it yet. My brother gets incarcerated for DUI. DUI maybe. Gets sentenced to 6 years. And I remember I was like, I'm not gonna treat the cancer. I'm gonna let it kill me. I fully conceded to that. I was like, I'm done. I'm checking out. I've had enough of this ride. And it wasn't happening fast enough because they're like, well, it's not even staged yet. You know, you're probably going to be okay. And of course, I'm telling the world like, hey, I've got prostate cancer. I'm going to be dead soon. And they're like, no. You know, it's very early. You'll be okay. But of course, to the world, it's the worst thing ever. And I come up with this bright idea that I'm just going to kill myself. I'm just going to do it. And I go back to the family home where there's nobody living there. We've moved most of the furniture out. Like I said, I was living with my mom at the time. And David talked about getting dark, so I'm gonna get dark. I had tied an orange extension cord to my ceiling fan. I remember pulling the weight on it, see if it would support my weight. And I couldn't do it. I was gonna do it, couldn't do it. And I thought to myself, when I drink, I can do anything. I know if I get nice and drunk that I will be able to go through with it. And I got nice and drunk and felt better. Felt better. You know, that pressure valve was released. And I was like, hey, whatever, man. She, you know, she's a bitch anyways. And I of course do what I always do. I black out and I get a call the next morning from the suicide hotline. And they're like, hey, you called us last night. And I'm like, I did. I'm like, oh, that's weird. I don't remember calling you. They're like, do you have somebody to be with? I was like, yeah, my mom's gonna. I called my mom to come pick me up. And I remember, once again, just like at the hospital, I remember thinking, walking out of my house, this is crazy, man. I'm done. I've got to quit. This stuff has got a hold of me like nothing else. For some reason, because what happens for me when I stop drinking? Because when I started that whole endeavor of hanging myself, I was sober. But I hate myself when I'm sober. And that's the obsession of the mind for me, that I am restless and irritable and discontented until I can again experience what comes from drinking. And that's what happened. I drank and I had the ease and comfort. The pressure valve was released. And that is the cycle I go through. When I do not drink, my life does not get better. You know, and if you give me the proposition, life is going to suck when I'm sober. It's going to suck when I'm drunk. I'm probably just going to drink. That's if I'm left with those choices. And that's where I go. And the cycle completely goes over. The world is askew when I'm sober. Everything's a little bit off. Everybody's looking at me sideways. Nobody respects me. My kids don't do what I want them to do. The world is just not enough for me. And then I start to extract control from other things. And start to try to change everybody around me. Don't do this. Hey, I'm not drinking for 30 days. Don't drink around me. Be careful. It'll trick me. You know, I'm walking around telling people how they'll live their life. You know, and at this point, I'm not with my wife, so I'm going from woman to woman. I'm using women for ease and comfort. I'm using drugs and alcohol for ease and comfort. And I don't know what to do. But after that night of thinking about killing myself, I'm like, and I had been at this point, I had been to some AA meetings. Matter of fact, my first meeting was an NA meeting at the psych center. And I had heard a little bit about AA, but I wasn't willing to accept. So step one in my mind was done. But the other steps, I was not ready to make a decision to take the rest of these steps. I started to believe at that moment, though, I cannot do this by myself. I've tried everything. I've read every book. I've tried every plan out there, every self-help book. I could keep going on, but I'll shut up. Recently, I was cleaning out my old Kindle. I found my old Kindle, and I was looking through books from like 2008, and I had a book called How to Get Rid of Anxiety Without Drinking. Like I had those kinds of books all throughout my Kindle library. And I'm like, oh my God, I forgot about all these books, but I was trying all these ways to not drink. And here I am again, left with no other solution. So that was like my Bill W. moment. And just like Bill W., I drank again. I drank later that day. I could not bring my brain to feel what I felt earlier. I drank again anyways. And I would keep doing that for two more years. But this time, after that moment, I started really going to a lot of meetings, lots and lots of meetings, and my life got even worse. Anyways, that's all I got for you.
The part in this reading that stuck out to me is the part where it says, the idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. I never wanted to be other people. I wanted to be not myself. There was a lot of envy about, you know, my neighbors and things like that, but I didn't want to drink like a normal person. Like I had no desire to do that. I drank because drinking felt good. And because, I don't know, in retrospect, I guess because drinking lowered my inhibitions enough for me to do all of the other things that I liked to do. You know, I never thought about, like, I have notes. So like, I didn't think about the pain. I never thought ahead of drinking, ahead of consuming. I never thought like, oh, don't you remember what you did last time? That never occurred to me, nor did I ever try to bring it about for myself. When I was 15, I can remember sitting on the couch in my grandmother's house. And, you know, it was during the day and I was at home and I was drinking and I was doing other things that I wasn't supposed to be doing. But I can remember that was the first time that I ever thought to myself, this is who you are. This is who you're going to be. You're going to be somebody who drinks, somebody who smokes, somebody who takes drugs. That's who you're going to be. And it did not occur to me until much, much later that I actually didn't want to be that person. And that, you know, the gateway, I guess, I don't really know another way to put that. Like the gateway to all of that for me was alcohol. I was 3 months sober with a sponsor, working the steps, time to do my fourth step. And I, like at the same time, was allowing myself to be tortured by a person who was in my life, that, you know, I honestly think that God intervened on my behalf in a really messed up way and removed this person from my life because I was not going to be able to do it on my own. But that person was still torturing me. He was doing things like going on Tinder dates and letting the people that he was on Tinder dates call me and video chat me while they were doing things. And I was destroyed. And I had already tried to run my car into a house. I had already tried climbing into a window armed. I had already tried all of these really crazy things. I didn't want to drink though. I would have rather do all of those things than drink. And I was talking to my sponsor about these things at the time also, because I did not want to drink. I had a plan, and my plan was to buy X amount of booze, get X amount of bags, get this person. I had rented the hotel room. Some of the things were already there. And I drove myself down to the oceanfront, one of the parking garages, fully prepared to throw myself off of the top of that parking garage. And I don't remember if I picked up the phone to call my friend or if this person called me and said, "Hey, why are you not at work right now?" But that person had a conversation with me about an alternative, which looked like going to a therapist. Oh yeah, I have been in therapy since I was like 9 years old, never told the full truth to anyone. Nobody ever asked me if I was on drugs. Nobody ever asked me if I was drinking. But I was 28 years old, just going to a therapist who I had never met before, actually told this person the full truth about myself and what my life looked like. And I was able to check myself into the Virginia Beach Psych Center, where I stayed for a little while. And like that wasn't even like my bottom where I stopped drinking, because like I got in there and I did the thing and I did intensive outpatient and I did all these other things. And then like pain got real again. Things were happening in my life again that I was uncomfortable with and didn't know how to manage. And so I ended up going back to alcohol. That's all I got.
Thank you. We're going to continue on page 30. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. Larry?
Man, that describes it. This idea that I have, and for me, look, it's pure science, right? You put enough alcohol in anyone, they're going to get drunk and maybe do something stupid. The part that confused me is why I had all this evidence of why it was a bad idea. But I still believe that this time it was going to be different. You know, this time I'm going to find a way to just have three. I'm going to do that. I'd always have this intention, like fully intending on just having a few, and I could never hit that mark. And if I did, the rare occasions that I did, I was completely miserable and everybody around me was miserable. And that's this, you know, the way it talks about it, thinking that I could drink like other people, you know, at some point I started coming to AA meetings. I wasn't doing AA yet, but I was coming to AA meetings. And I had this really bright idea that if maybe I'm around, you know, I thought I could build up a tolerance. So I started to go to bars and hang around bars, because if I'm around, it's almost, I don't know, I'm going to date myself. Brewster's Millions, where his grandfather like makes him go smoke a million cigars. So he'll never want to do it again. I thought if I was near it, that somehow I'd build up this tolerance for it. And then over time I could learn how to drink normally. If I'm just away from it long enough, it'll kill it off, whatever's going on in me. And at this point, I don't even know what's wrong with me. I'm thinking everything else is wrong with me. And that's the difficult part of step one for me, is at this point, I'm going to a bunch of meetings and I'm not identifying with people. I'm not identifying with stories. I don't understand what's going on with me. I'm crazy. I'm not like these people, is what I keep telling myself. But what happened was I started to go. I went to a lot of Chesapeake meetings, and I had to go to other areas, and I came out here in Norfolk, and I heard these group of guys that were talking about alcoholism when it's not treated. And they were talking about what it feels like when I don't drink. And I remember, I can remember as clear as day, sitting in Candlelight, thinking to myself that those guys, whatever they're describing, that's what I got. They said what I got. They said it. And it was like an epiphany to me. Someone finally said what I had. They talked about this feeling that I feel when I'm sober, this obsession of the mind that I'm planning on my next drink. I'm planning on it. I don't even know I'm planning on it, but I'm planning on it. I cannot wait to get it because I am utterly miserable when I'm sober. And I'm like, what is the solution to that? But I still have this delusion that maybe, man, maybe. And for me, that delusion was smashed when I was completely sober. I was in Baltimore, Maryland. I was in a room full of people. Everybody's having a grand old time. And I'm just at the end of a room, probably four times the size of this. And people are having a great time. And I'm just utterly, completely alone in my head, thinking that I don't know what to do. Maybe this 12 steps crap isn't, you know, as crazy as I thought it was. Maybe at some point, and I remember the first time I ever shared in a meeting. I had been going to the meetings at this point for 2.5 years. I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings for 2.5 years, never opened my mouth, never took a number, which is crazy because today I don't shut up. But at that point, I never opened my mouth. And I raised my hand in a meeting. It was a Friday night meeting in Chesapeake. And I told them what I'd been doing, how I think I got this idea, this plan where if I'm around it, this is going to be Larry's version of Alcoholics Anonymous. I figured out something you idiots didn't figure out. All you got to do is like go around it and eventually you'll build up a tolerance. And I shared this in a meeting. And after the meeting, my wife was like, if you had a sponsor, you know, they could take you through the 12 steps and maybe you won't have these great ideas. And I said, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I don't need one of those sponsor things. I don't need to do that. I'm going to do this step thing on my own. I'm going to figure out a different way to do this. The next few days later, I go to my therapist because I also have been in therapy half my life. And I tell her what I'd been doing. And she says, if you had a sponsor. See, the thing is, my therapist was an Al-Anon. She knows all about the 12 steps. And she was always telling me, she's actually the one that convinced me to start going to AA meetings. She's like, I'll help you with all the depression, anxiety stuff, but you need to go to the experts on drinking. And so I took her advice and she was like, get a sponsor, maybe do the 12 steps and you will stop doing this stuff. And I said, you know, that's a great idea. That's what I'm going to do. And I approached one of those dudes at that Candlelight meeting who I did not like. I thought they laughed too much. They talked about sea bags too much. They carried the little book around too much. But that man walked up to me and I asked him, before he even got his name out, I asked, would you be my sponsor? And he said, yes. And he took me through these 12 steps rapidly. Step one was difficult for me. And I know I'm talking, I'll be quiet in a second. Because my job title at work is I'm not only a manager, I am a senior man. So I manage shit. And you're telling me that my life is unmanageable? I don't think so. I got a big old car. I got a big old house. I got a wife who came back to me, but my sponsor had me read page 50 about the devil. And that is where my life was unmanageable. Really, I can't control my drinking. I can't even control my thoughts. I can't control how I feel when I am sober. I am prone to depression. I feel useless. I feel nothing to anybody. I could either be on this earth or not. It really doesn't matter to me. That sounds pretty unmanageable. All that other crap, There's nothing in the book that there's no chart that says how much I got to have to drink in a certain amount of time. There's no chart that says how many DUIs I got to get, how many things that I've done in my life, even though I've done a lot of that stuff. It'll tell me in the very first paragraph of We Agnostic that do you have trouble controlling your drinking? And do you find it difficult to stay quit? Well, then you're probably an alcoholic. That's it. That's all it says. All that other crap is just a cherry on top. Anyways, that's all I got for now.
Thanks, sir.
So smashed. That was the word in this particular reading that stuck out to me, and it always sticks out to me. A lot of the language in the big book, it's there's lots of flair to it. He also talks about like being out at sea and like military kind of stuff. But smashed. I didn't know I was delusional. I never wanted to drink like other people. Like that particular sentence, delusion that we are like other people or presently might be. I did not want to be like other people. I knew I was not like other people. Other people at 16, 17 years old were not prostituting themselves to do, you know, drugs and to drink. They were not doing that. People in my high school, I didn't know anybody else who was doing the things that I was doing. But I'm so special. Like that's the other thing about alcoholism is like, there's this, I don't know. There's this, I'm here. I'm all alone. I'm doing these things. Nobody likes me. Nobody's doing this. But then there's this other part where it's like, I want to be one of you guys. Because I have to be one of you guys. That's what I've learned in sobriety is like, I have to be part of this in order to have this. You know, I talked a little while ago about like having the drink and that really being like the gateway to everything else. Well, alcohol was the first thing that I ever put in my body that made me feel good. And it was also the last thing that I ever put into my body that made me feel the way that alcohol made me feel, like that cloud, like that ease, that relax. And then the demoralization, well, I've already shared a little bit about that, but you know, alcohol for me, it allows me to do the things that I need to do to get what I want, which 9 times out of 10 looks like a bottle. It looks like something powdery. It looks like your wife or your husband or other things like that. Things that make me feel good. I have no idea, you know, what it is like to have any kind of respect for other people, for spaces around me. That's what that demoralization looks like for me. That's where I got. And I said early on, it got me to my kitchen floor, staring into the bottom, staring at bottles and not knowing how to not take a drink. That night I called the AA hotline and someone very kind spoke to me for several hours until they had to get ready for work. Then they passed me off to somebody else. And then my grand sponsor at the time came to my house and picked me up. And we went to like 3 meetings that day. And I've been here ever since then. You know, it talks about, we say progress, not perfection. I had gotten to experience the progressive nature of my alcoholism prior to that. It was awful. I had, they say in the rooms, a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. I was 4 days into that belly full of booze. I had taken a bunch of pills to try to help myself go to sleep and I couldn't do it. And that was my bottom so far. That was it for me. Step one and like how I got to step one. It's not a lot of sunshine. But that day, you know, that day I was able to admit that my life was unmanageable. I could not go on the way that I was going. I couldn't. I was losing my marriage. I was scared. I became fearful that I could possibly lose my child because I thought my wife was going to tell on me to my family. You know, I had to take some actions in order to, you know, protect my life and to also protect my child. You know, I did send my daughter back home. She came here to be with my family for a little while. I did go to another therapist saying, you know, I'm not drinking anymore and I'm working with my sponsor and we're doing these steps again. And I remember what happened last time and I'm kind of freaking out a little bit. I think I need to go back. It happened that that particular therapist was in the rooms. I didn't know that when I went to the therapist appointment because I didn't know the doctor. I didn't know this guy's last name. But when I showed up, that was somebody that I knew from the rooms. And, you know, he was like, when was the last time you called your sponsor and you got honest about some things? It had been a little while. So instead of going into the psych center again, because I mean, I will be honest, being in the psych center, take me to summer camp. I love to have somebody else tell me what to do. I like to take naps. I love puzzles. I love group therapy. Absolutely. But I didn't do that again. I didn't do that. I called my sponsor. I started telling the truth, the real truth again, about myself, and unmanageable, completely unmanageable. You know, but and that's only stuff. You know, there's a lot more steps to come.
All right. I'm going to mash up the last two readings and then you guys, looks like you got about maybe 3 minutes each. Let's see, page 41. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that first evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I'd made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesized that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more, for what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
Larry. Yeah. I'll try to be quick. So that last sentence, that was tough for me. I could concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, that my life was unmanageable. I didn't like that you all would say surrender because I'm Japanese and I thought that was offensive. But like I admitted it, but honestly, you know, after sitting down and reading this book, part of what was helpful for those first couple, at least the first three chapters, was that it was explaining to me what alcoholism was. And I wasn't aware what alcoholism was. I had no idea what alcoholism was. I had that meme version of alcoholism. I thought alcoholism was not really the guy under the bridge, but like I didn't think it was what I was. I wasn't aware of the obsession of the mind, the phenomenon of craving. I've never heard that before until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I even thought AA was meetings. Like I wasn't aware there was a book. I wasn't aware there was a program, which is the 12 steps. All of this stuff was very foreign to me. So sitting down with a sponsor and reading this book and having this book explain to me what alcoholism was, then I was like, oh, well, yeah, that's what I got. So I was great on that. But I kind of believed that, you know, a decade ago. What do I do with that? Okay. You know, I am a firm believer that I cannot find a solution to a problem I don't think I have, but now I understand I have the problem. Well, if I've defined the problem in the first step, then what is the solution? And you all said, God, and I was like, I don't know. I don't want to do that. But like, it begs the question, if I'm powerless, I have to find power. If I am powerless, it's just the next inevitable question I have to ask. What is that going to happen? And it tells us in the book, the purpose of this book is not to show me how to stop drinking. The purpose of the book is to help me find a spiritual solution that's going to solve all those things. All of that restlessness, that irritability. I don't believe that the phenomenon of craving has been cured in me. I believe the obsession of the mind is, because I don't have to test the phenomenon of craving anymore because the obsession of the mind is gone. I've had a psychic change. I can take it or leave it. It can be in my house. I can be around it. I can smell it.
Honestly, I remember one time I went to Rudy's Inlet and I had clam chowder and they put a little too much sherry in cook out and I spit it out instinctively. And it says we're going to react like that, like from a hot flame I recoiled from. I was like, oh, it tasted disgusting to me. I don't know what that is other than a spiritual solution that changed the way my brain is rewired and it fixed something where I do not obsess over it every day. Here's the problem. Here's the hook is that when I drift away from this spiritual program, all that restlessness and irritability and discontent, I start up here and I'm like, hey, I don't feel like going to a meeting. I'm not going to call anybody. Man, I feel pretty depressed. Hey, I want to isolate. I want to be around people. Man, that dude's looking at me weird. Man, I feel awful. Anxiety, depression, bottom, drink. If I pull myself out of that hole and I keep doing what I'm doing, it's easier to pull myself out here than way down here. That's what I do today. These 12 steps for me are like a seatbelt. And I don't only wear my seatbelt when it's stormy and raining outside. I wear it all times because I never know when the Mack truck's going to hit me from the side. You know, if I'm only using AA when life is rough, things are going to get difficult when I least expect it. So I keep doing exactly what I did, which is I work with a sponsor and I try to help other people. That's what I do now. All those self-help books that I read, I found one. It's called a Help Others book. That's what this book is. Anyways, that's all I got.
Thanks.
So I hear it said in meetings, I feel like I've said that like six times already, but that AA isn't for people who want it or need it. It's for people who do it. And that's because in order for Alcoholics Anonymous to work, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to work, the steps to work, you actually have to do them. I actually have to do them. I have to put the work in. And my little handy post-it note pretty much says everything that Larry just said. It's like,
I read it.
Read my note. You stole my thing. Sometimes like what Alcoholics Anonymous looks like to me is sometimes I am more of service. I am part of a home group. I'm actually part of the same home group that Larry is part of. I'm the secretary, but for half of the year, that has not really looked too good. If I'm being completely honest, I have other positions. I do other things in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I also do this thing called living my life and being a parent to a child who has given me the opportunity to be her parent. At 8 years old, 9, 10, my daughter told me, I don't trust you. Now at 15, that's changed. You know, that's changed now. And it is only because I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is only because I work a program in Alcoholics Anonymous. And yeah, sometimes it doesn't look great. Sometimes people call me and they're like, are you doing okay? I'm like, yeah, I think I'm okay. I think I'm doing all right. Well, there's these little things, you know. Sometimes I get the opportunity to pick up a phone and call an alcoholic and say, hey, are you doing okay? Because that's what we do for each other. My sobriety does not look like the sobriety of everybody else in this room. And that's just a fact. But, you know, we're all here. We're all doing this. It's a design for living. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. I owe a debt that I will never be able to repay. And it starts here. It starts at step one. So thanks.
Thank you. We are going to pass the baskets. You guys will have an opportunity to come up and thank Amy and Larry after the meeting. The Seven Tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seven Tradition is essential. At every level of AA service, it is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements for the good of AA tonight?
I got one.
Ed.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ed. Bobby?
Good Friday this month is December 30th. We will have a guest speaker coming from D.C. Can't seem to get rid of him. Jonathan Pankow is going to be at 8. And then I have probably
I don't want to.
1301 College.
So we moved from not sure we're going to have food to we're probably going to have some food.
I don't think we've even decided. Larry Alcoholic, December 8th, the Cane to Believe Women's Meeting is celebrating 27 years. They meet on Man Drive in Chesapeake. It's a women's meeting.
You're the only one that thinks
that's I know. Funny. I think it's hilarious. The women's meeting that meets on Man Drive. Yeah. So at 6 o'clock, they will start eating. It's a potluck. 7 o'clock is the meeting. It's on the Intergroup website. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you. Any other announcements? Thanks, Bob. Point out that there's literature available over there yonder on the hand sanitizing station. It's not. Doesn't have any hand sanitizer, but there is hand sanitizer out in the hall if you need it. But anyway, we got books over there if you need them. If you can fold it, it's free. Otherwise, see a home group member. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we're going to be here at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to come and talk to any of us. Or if you're shy, send an email to info@simpleactions.net. Reminder, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. All are invited and encouraged to join us at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol on 22nd and Colonial. In closing, can we all thank Amy and Larry again, please? Thank everyone who participated. After the Lord's Prayer, everyone will have a chance to come up and thank them in person. And I've asked Grant to read the last couple of paragraphs on page 164.
I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Grant.
Grant.
A vision for you from Big Fat Page. Our book is meant to be. We realize God will constantly disclose more to you and to ask him each day. The answers will come. Own houses, but obviously you can't. God, see to it that your relationship with him is right. And great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellow. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you tread the road of happy. God bless you.
All right. How about we come up to the front and we'll do a circle around this table here so the Zoom people can see.
Zoom people.
The Zooms. Come on.
Hurry up.
Our Father.
Our Father. Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom,